From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Chiquita Banana Company, under its CEO Carl Lindner, has a disgraceful record of practicing every form of skullduggery in its operations abroad.
Is Chiquita buying U.S. foreign policy? Today we look behind the banana wars at why the U.S. is threatening to sanction the European Union, and a review of the drug cases of the sons of influential men, like U.S. lawmakers Richard Shelby, Duke Cunningham, and Dan Burton. We'll compare their cases to those of ordinary people around the country. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. A week after U.S. and British bombing raids, Iraq is threatening to fire on Western aircraft patrolling the so-called no-fly zones in the north and south of Iraq. Iraqi Vice President Yassin Ramadan says these zones are illegal and a violation of Iraq's national sovereignty. The zones cover more than half the country, set up after 1991, the U.S.-led assault against Iraq, ostensibly to protect the Iraqi Shias in the south and the Kurds in the north. Ramadan told reporters in Amman this weekend the flights were nothing but spy missions and part of an ongoing aggression against Iraq. Britain says the flights will continue and warned that British aircraft would retaliate if they are shot at. Ramadan's statements followed a claim by Baghdad on Saturday that its air defenses had fired at enemy aircraft attacking in southern Iraq. The U.S. and Britain deny the report. Meanwhile, Iraq's trade minister, Mohammed Mehdi Saleh, is denying media reports that Iraq would curtail the so-called oil-for-food deal with the United Nations and ask U.N. relief staff to leave the country. Saleh told reporters he'd been misquoted in earlier reports that said Iraq was looking to scrap the program. He added the U.N. observers can stay in Iraq as long as there's an oil-for-food program. It allows Baghdad to sell almost $5.3 billion of oil every 6 months to buy food, medicines and other supplies to ease the impact on ordinary Iraqis of the eight-year-old U.N. sanctions. Asked if Iraq would reject a further extension of the program after it runs out in 5 months' time, Saleh said the Iraqi government has not made a decision on whether to cancel it. But he said the program was temporary and Iraq's demand is to lift the sanctions. Saleh said the UN relief staff began work today for the first time since they returned to Baghdad after being evacuated to Amman, Jordan, to escape U.S. and British air raids earlier this month. More than 25 people were murdered over the Christmas weekend in South Africa's volatile KwaZulu-Natal province, but police are saying politics is so far not a motive in any of the killings. A police spokesperson says although the death toll was high, the festive season had not been more bloody than usual in the region, which has been a hotbed of political violence since the mid-1980s. In the most vicious attack, 7 men and 1 woman were shot dead by a group of armed men at family festivities on Christmas Eve in the coastal town of Margate. Reports said 3 of the victims were members of the ruling African National Congress. But police say robbery was the suspected motive for the attack after the killers made off with a hi-fi and TV set. President Nelson Mandela said he was shocked and outraged by the Margate killing, especially as the shooting occurred when the country was preparing for the most peaceful festive season so far in KwaZulu-Natal. KwaZulu-Natal has been the scene of several clashes between supporters of the ANC and the predominantly Zulu-based Inkatha Freedom Party, in which thousands of people have died. Here in the United States, union leaders say they'd nothing to do with dozens of TWA flight attendants calling in sick during Christmas. The airline's St. Louis hub was paralyzed on Christmas Eve and Christmas. TWA canceled more than 200 flights during the holiday weekend because of what the company calls a sick out. Union officials admit flight attendants are angry they don't have a new contract, but they say the company's spinning the events to give itself more leverage at the bargaining table. A union official says there was no sick out and that this year's absences were similar to last year's. The two sides resume contract talks on January 18th. Talks about the logistics of a Senate impeachment trial are expected to intensify this week as the 106th Congress prepares to convene on January 6th. Meanwhile, key lawmakers say they don't want to spend too much time on impeachment. The push for a speedy trial is quickly gaining momentum among senators from both parties, but Republicans say senators should consider censure only after a trial begins. Several senators said on the Sunday TV talk shows they want the matter concluded in the first 2 months of the year. Many senators believe there's little chance of mustering the two-thirds majority needed to convict and remove President Clinton from office. Authorities in Colombia say they fear the death toll from a pipeline explosion could rise. At least 12 people are dead after a natural gas pipeline exploded today in a rural hamlet north of the capital, Bogota. Another 80 were injured. State health officials say the blast killed 9 people immediately. 3 died in hospitals. The blast was clearly very large. It sent rocks flying and brought down power lines, setting homes on fire. And the Honduran government is hoping that 65% of its foreign debt will be forgiven in the wake of Hurricane Mitch. Honduran Minister of International Cooperation Moises Starkman told reporters yesterday such debt relief would open up the resources needed to rebuild the country after the region's worst storm this century. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. For years, members of Congress have been trying to outdo each other in terms of their support for tough counter-drug legislation. From building more prisons, increasing police budgets in the U.S., to stepping up military aid and enhancing illicit crop eradication programs in drug-producing countries, the war on drugs continues to be one of the most politically attractive issues for politicians. One example of this politicking can be seen in the stringent mandatory minimum drug sentencing laws, which have been in effect since 1986. These sentencing laws limit a judge's ability to hand down sentences and drug convictions according to the particular consequences of a case. Critics say these laws have led to unfair sentences for minor drug offenders while leaving major drug traffickers off the hook. They also argue these laws have torn families apart throughout the country, leading to jail overcrowding while having little impact on the overall drug problem. But how are these laws applied when family members of U.S. lawmakers are themselves breaking the law? Is there a double standard for drug warrior Congress members who are able to use their influence to get a son or a wife off the hook, while thousands of others have to pay the full price for breaking the law? Today, we're going to take a look at a few Republican lawmakers who found themselves in this position. And we're going to be talking with family members of ordinary Americans who are in prison today because of the mandatory minimums and find out what their stories are. We're going to start with attorney Eric Sterling of the Criminal Justice Policy Foundation. He's a former counsel to the House Judiciary Committee. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning, Amy.
Well, it's good to be with you. Why don't you start out by just laying out for us what these federal mandatory minimum sentences are? And I also just want to let people know that one of the reasons we're looking at this today is it's just after the holiday season. And around the country, people who are in prison, a number of people, were waiting to hear if they got clemency, a kind of Christmas clemency. We're hoping to speak with someone from a prison in New York who actually didn't get clemency. But we're going to find out about her case and why it relates to this issue of mandatory minimums. But Eric Sterling, about federal mandatory minimum sentencing, what is it all about? Where did it get its start?
Federal mandatory minimums were created in 1986 in a hasty political climate. The Democrats were looking to win the 1986 election, and they had been clobbered in 1984 over the crime issue. In the last couple days of the committee's consideration of a massive anti-drug bill that had been conceived by former House Speaker Tip O'Neill, the idea was put forward to impose fixed sentences of 5 or 10 years against what people said were going to be high-level drug traffickers. But and these would be based upon quantities that would be involved in the drug case. However, congressmen don't speak metric very fluently, and they ended up picking very low quantities. In the case of crack cocaine, for example, as little as 5 grams, about the weight of 2 pennies, triggered a 5-year mandatory federal prison term. It's important to recognize that when a ton of cocaine gets smuggled into the country, we're talking about 1 million grams of cocaine. So the quantities that Congress picked were actually very, very small quantities in the global drug market. The numbers had started higher in the committee, but were whittled down in the political back and forth between the Republicans who controlled the Senate and the Democrats who controlled the House of Representatives, each party trying to appear tougher in that debate. The problem was aggravated in 1988 when the Justice Department said, well, you've made a mistake. You didn't apply these mandatories to people who are members of conspiracies to smuggle drugs. The consequence then became that everyone who was involved was liable for the entire quantity that the entire organization might have been involved with, so that people who had the most minor role in a drug trafficking operation, whether the person simply opened the door at a crack house or unloaded an airplane, or simply a courier walking across the border, was responsible for everything that all the weight by all of the participants. And so extremely long sentences got passed. This was a big departure from the federal drug law that had been adopted in 1970 and what was considered an important reform of federal drug laws.
Eric Sterling, let's talk about some of the cases of the sons of influential men, the lawmakers who are actually making these laws, and what has happened to them. And then we'll compare them to some specific cases of people around the country who are serving many years in prison. Let's talk about Republican Senator Richard Shelby, head of the Senate Intelligence Committee, Indiana Congressmember Dan Burton, well known for being a real attack dog against President Clinton, as well as California conservative Republican Duke Cunningham.
In recent years, sons of each of those members of Congress were involved in drug trafficking offenses, and in each case got very minor treatment. In the case of Senator Shelby, his son flew into the United States carrying about 13 grams of hashish. That's about a half ounce. Not a particularly large amount of drugs. The only irony is that he was flying into the airport in Atlanta, and the congressman from that nearby, House Speaker Newt Gingrich, had proposed that the death penalty be imposed against anyone who brought into the United States more than 100 dosage units. According to the way in which the government calculates dosage units of hashish, that would have been more than 100 dosage units, and in the kind of legislative rhetoric that flies around Capitol Hill, the death penalty would have been considered appropriate for Senator Shelby's son. However, I think he ended up paying a $500 fine.
Wait, you have to explain that because people may be a little shocked when you talk about the death penalty. We're not talking about a murder here.
No, we're talking about the simple crossing of a United States border carrying more than 100 dosage units of an illegal drug. And in the case of the death penalty, it would have been if a person had a prior conviction of some kind for a death penalty. For a first offense, it would have been a mandatory life imprisonment, and the federal system abolished parole 1984 law. So that in this case, if this law that Speaker Gingrich had made a centerpiece of his political rhetoric around the war on drugs, Senator Shelby's son would have gone to prison for the rest of his life.
And instead, again, he got...
I believe it was a $500 fine, and he was shortly released, which is probably not an inappropriate kind of penalty for that kind of offense.
Hmm. And what about California Congressman Duke Cunningham, also prides himself on being a drug warrior?
Congressman Cunningham's son is a more interesting, a more complex case. He was involved in an organization that was flying marijuana from, I believe it was California, to Massachusetts, and was caught landing in an airplane in an airport in an airplane with 400 pounds of marijuana. 100 pounds of marijuana in a trafficking offense typically triggers the 5-year mandatory minimum sentence. Cunningham's son pleaded guilty to that offense and two other marijuana smuggling offenses, but got a sentence of about 2.5 years. And apparently that's in part because he, while he was on release and being urine tested, he came up with a dirty urine 3 times for the use of cocaine. He got the lesser sentence by a very important loophole that exists in this mandatory sentencing law, which allows people who cooperate, who provide substantial assistance to prosecutors, it allows the prosecutors to say to the judge, this person has worked for us and therefore should get a lower sentence. That provision was recently held by a U.S. court, the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals that sits in Denver, as illegal because it really constitutes bribery and is a violation of the federal bribery statute. And in a unanimous decision of a panel there, struck it down. The full court, the full 12-judge panel, vacated that decision. It's a case called Singleton, and this has the potential, if it's upheld, or if it goes to the Supreme Court, of potentially being one of the most important criminal law cases in the country. That is, whether or not prosecutors can use the offer of reduced testimony, reduced sentences, to get people to testify on their behalf. A defense attorney can't offer money or anything of value to a witness to testify on behalf of their client, but the government can offer freedom to someone who testifies on their case. That's what Cunningham's son did. He was offered freedom for testifying. It's not clear from anything I read exactly what that testimony was, so he got a sentence that was about 1/2 of the mandatory minimum for his role in 3 marijuana smuggling operations from, I think, California to Massachusetts.
And finally, Attorney Eric Sterling, the case of the son of Congressmember Dan Burton. We only have a minute before we go to our break, and then we're going to compare that to someone who is currently serving a 10-year prison sentence today.
Briefly, Congressman Burton's son was prosecuted both in Indiana and in Louisiana for being involved in the sale of illegal drugs. In one case, the charges were dismissed. In the other case, he got probation. In neither case did the federal government try to prosecute him for the in that case. He was very lucky, either great lawyering or very lucky.
And so, in his case, did his father intervene, or was it just the...
I don't know that his father intervened.
Eric Sterling is an attorney with the Criminal Justice Policy Foundation and a former counsel to the House Judiciary Committee from 1979 to 1989. When we come back, we'll be joined by the wife of a man in New York in a prison upstate who is serving a 10-year sentence for a similar offense. We'll also be speaking to a judge who is opposed to mandatory minimums. And we'll talk with a representative of families in California who are dealing with mandatory minimum sentencing there. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman, and today we're talking about mandatory minimum sentences. We're talking about drug laws, we're talking about Congress, federal sentences, and also state sentencing laws. We're joined right now by Susan Stoner, who is a member of FAM, an organization that that's the acronym for Families Against Mandatory Minimums. They're all over the country. We're also joined by attorney Eric Sterling of the Criminal Justice Policy Foundation. And as well, we're going to hopefully talk to someone from a prison in a few minutes. But right now, Susan Stoner, you heard Eric Sterling describe the cases of these three Congress members. Their sons, the cases of Senator Shelby, Congressmember Dan Burton, Congressmember Duke Cunningham. Can you tell us about your husband, who is currently in a New Jersey prison?
Yes, good morning, Amy.
Good morning.
That makes me very angry when I hear about things like that. My husband is serving a 10-year mandatory minimum for a first-time offense, nonviolent, for growing marijuana. He didn't receive any breaks whatsoever. The prosecutors have all the power, and the judges have no discretion against how to sentence a person accordingly. He was guilty of his offense, and he does, you know, deserve to be punished, but 10 years is very excessive for a family man, a good member of the community. We have two children who were 8 and 10 when he left us, and they'll be 17 and 19 when he comes home, so they'll be pretty much full grown.
He is serving 10 years. Did the judge have a choice?
No, the judge had no choice. The judge said that he doesn't like the mandatory minimums. He really doesn't even like the way the guidelines work, but he has no choice. He had to give my husband a 10-year sentence because that's what the prosecution was charging my husband with. So the judge has no discretion. He just sits up there like a puppet on a string when the prosecutor does everything.
In addition to Susan Stoner, we're joined by Virginia Ressner, who's coordinator of the California chapter of Families Against Mandatory Minimums, which is the national advocacy group that Susan Stoner is also a part of. Is this a typical example, Susan Stoner's husband?
Good morning. This is Virginia calling, speaking from San Francisco. Amy, this is an excellent example of where we see the disparity in sentencing. And I think this is a real wake-up call to Americans across the country that demonstrates that we truly do not have equal justice under the law when we see disparities of this type in drug cases.
Can you tell us some of the cases of the families that you're dealing with in San Francisco?
Well, I mean, the families that exist here in California and San Francisco, particularly to those that are also sentenced under the federal mandatory minimums, are as similar as they are anywhere around the country. These sentences are all based on the type of drug and the weight of drug, as Eric Sterling mentioned. A judge is not permitted to look at the mitigating circumstances in a case and look at a defendant's personal background, what their education is, for example, what their contribution to the community is. It's all based on the type of drug and the weight of the drug, and that's what is translated into the sentence. There's no ifs, ands, and buts about it, so there really isn't any breaks. So each person, each family around the country is impacted in the same way because the sentences are very long and very harsh, and it makes it very difficult for families such as this, for Susan, with two young children, to survive financially, emotionally. And 10 years is a long time to wait for her husband to come home and help her raise those children.
You know, yesterday I spent up at Bedford Hills, which is a maximum security prison for women just outside of New York City. And it was just after Christmas, of course, and it was a very depressed time there. There are about 800 women at the prison because the governor, who has aspirations for higher office, Governor George Pataki of New York, did not grant any clemencies this year. I was speaking with Donna Charles, who is a woman who was one of the top of the list to get clemency. Her own judge advocated for her, saying that she should not have gotten the 17 years that the judge was forced to sentence her to. There are state laws in New York, the Rockefeller drug laws in effect since 1973, require 15 to life minimum for crimes that, you know, are certainly nonviolent and involve very minimal amounts of drugs. We're joined on the phone right now by Judge Jerome Marks. He is a retired Manhattan Supreme Court judge and a former New York State legislator, and has been dealing with these drug laws, well, dealt with them for almost a quarter of a century. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Judge Marks.
Yes, Amy.
Can you explain, as a judge, what these mandatory minimum sentences do?
Well, of course, in New York State, and I think we have the toughest drug laws in the nation. They were enacted in 1973. Rockefeller himself admitted it was the toughest drug laws. And, of course, they felt at that time, if they made the laws tough enough, we would reduce the drug problem. It hasn't worked out that way. In fact, it's a very unfair law. In addition, the law doesn't make sense at all. If you sell in New York over 2 ounces of hard drugs, or you possess over 4 ounces, the penalty is the same as homicide, as murder. The minimum sentence is 15 years, the max to life, and the maximum is 25 years to life. 95% or more of the defendants plead guilty under this law. Usually what happens, especially if you're dealing with the first offender, the district attorney will make an offer. For example, you plead guilty, we'll give you 3 years to life. Any good lawyer is going to accept that plea, because it is, to go to trial on in a drug case, it's the easiest conviction on the books. It's the easiest arrest and the easiest conviction, because in every case, first of all, we have undercover police officers who make by. In every case, we'll have a professional witness, a police officer who testifies. In almost every case, they find additional evidence, or they have what they call buy money, the money that's paid over by the police officer, and these sentences are so severe. Now and then, a defendant, for some reason or another, either the lawyer doesn't know what he's doing, or the defendant insists on going to trial, feels that they're not guilty. They may not be guilty. I don't know. They don't all understand the law that has to do with accomplices. If you help somebody sell, you're just as guilty as he is. And if they are found guilty, even though they're first offenders, the minimum sentence the judge can give them is 15 years to life. And I've been up to Bedford Hills myself a dozen times, and I've talked to a dozen women, and one case is worse than the other. I've talked to at least 10 women who were first offenders who were doing at least 15 years to life or 20 to life, and you've got to do the 15 or the 20. I mean, and if it's, like, I got involved in this thing in 1994, 1995. I'm reading a case in our law journal which lists cases. I was retired already. And I read about a case, and Angela Thompson, she was 17 years of age. Uncle was a drug dealer. He got her to sell drugs. He was taking care of her because her mother died when she was seven. She was raised by her grandmother. The grandmother died. The uncle brings her up to New York. She works in a restaurant. She works in a beauty salon. But he happened to own a building up in Harlem, and one time he got her involved and told her he wanted her to sell drugs. She knew he was selling drugs, but this was her father. She sold drugs. It might have been the second time. She's arrested. She's off for 3 years to life. She sold just one-tenth of an ounce over 2 ounces. She's convicted. The trial takes one day. They offered her 3 to life. The uncle talks about her taking it. The original judge feels that this is a violation of the Constitution, gives her 8 years to life. The case goes up to our highest court, which is the Court of Appeals in New York. They reverse and said that the judge had no discretion, had to give her 15 years to life. I read about it. I got so angry. I drove up to the prison. I volunteered my services. She was a poor youngster. She had no lawyer. I filed for clemency for her. And I mean, this was something unusual for me, because for 22 years I'd been a judge, I'd been putting people away, not getting them out. This time I filed for clemency. I was fortunate. The media got involved. Bob Herbert wrote 4 columns in the New York Times.
television, radio, got involved, and last year we were fortunate and she got clemency. But her case is no different than hundreds of others in New York. If she had sold one-tenth of an ounce less, the judge could have given her 3 years to life. I mean, it's ridiculous. It doesn't make sense, Amy.
And that is Judge Jerome Marks, who is a man, as he said, who put people away for many years and now fought to get one young woman out last year. In fact, she did get clemency in New York State under the draconian Rockefeller drug laws. There is a movement to overturn these laws in effect for the last quarter of a century. But I wanted to go back to Eric Sterling, attorney with the Criminal Justice Policy Foundation. You were talking about the congressmembers' sons and how they got off on very minimal sentences or fines, though you were saying that maybe they actually are appropriate. It's the other people who are forced to undergo these draconian sentences, and maybe that the model should be how the sons of congressmembers were dealt with. But do you see any movement in Congress with these senators and congressmembers like Shelby, Burton, and Cunningham to turn around and reform these laws?
Amy, I'm sorry to say there's no really strong movement to change drug laws in the Congress. There is this is still political holy ground to be tough in the war on drugs, and the U.S. Congress, we can see the way in which they've gone after President Clinton. Common sense analysis of facts just don't seem to sway them to any degree. There was a proposal, for example, that the U.S. Sentencing Commission brought forward in 1995 to change the very big disparity in the way in which crack cocaine and powder cocaine cases are dealt with in the federal court. And it was overwhelmingly attacked by the Republicans, those who saw the kind of intense partisan difference in the House impeachment debate would have seen exactly the same kind of partisan talking at cross purposes in the effort to deal with this crack cocaine issue. Briefly, that crack cocaine issue is one of the classic examples of the historical racial discrimination that exists in the criminal justice system. In the nation, something on the order of 10 million of the nation's drug users are white and less than 2 million are black. But you find, of those who are arrested, according to the FBI data, over a third of those who are arrested for drug offenses are black. When you then look at who is convicted of drug trafficking, 63% in 1994 of those who were convicted were black. Now, there's no reason to believe that the evidence that narcotics investigators bring against African-American defendants is stronger than the evidence presented against white defendants. And yet you have this tremendous difference that already exists between arrest rate and conviction rate. You see the same thing then in terms of who goes to prison. Only 34% of the whites who are convicted of state drug felonies get prison sentences, but 54% of the blacks who are convicted of state drug felonies get prison sentences. So there's a 20% gap there.
You also talk, Eric, you also talk about the U.S. Sentencing Commission, but the fact is right now there is no U.S. Sentencing Commission. There's a commission, but all of the terms of the remaining commissioners have expired. And the last one, Chairman Conaboy, resigned in frustration. And so for the first time in the 12-year history of the Sentencing Commission, there's no one in charge.
The Sentencing Commission was considered one of the most important reforms of the Comprehensive Crime Control Act of 1984. The Congress debated sentencing reform throughout the 1970s and early 1980s when I was working for the committee. And it is a tremendous scandal that this commission has been allowed to disappear, if you will. In political nitpicking between the president, the Republicans, and the Democrats over who can get their appointee to this commission. The commission did very, very good work and had said in the case of crack cocaine, after extensive analysis, the addictive effects, the crime-causing effects, the harm to the users do not justify this difference between was 1 to 100 kind of difference. And that difference in the federal system has resulted in the case of crack cases, of only of less than 5% of the federal crack defendants are white. 88% are African-American, 7% are Hispanic. And this has been probably exhibit number one in the racially discriminatory effect of the way the drug laws are imposed.
Eric Sterling, we only have a few more minutes, and I want to give the last words to Susan Stoner and Virginia Ressner. We are looking at these laws that still remain in effect, both at the state and federal level. Virginia Ressner of the California Chapter of Families Against Mandatory Minimums, what are you doing right now in terms of organizing? What do you see as the key pressure point?
Well, I think in coming up with the 106th Congress, it's important that we concentrate on the appointment of commissioners to the U.S. Sentencing Commission. Additionally, each and every American needs to let their congressional representative know and let President Clinton know, either by faxing or telephoning or calling or writing, that these laws are absolutely not acceptable. They're un-American. They're undemocratic. They don't work. We've proven that they don't work and that we need to find other solutions. We need to invest in drug treatment. It's a smarter policy. And look at other ways in which we can resolve these issues and bring people home to their families.
Susan Stoner, let me ask you, in New York, as the New York State coordinator of the same group, FAM, Families Against Mandatory Minimums, giving you the last word, what you're doing here in the New York area, especially hit with both federal mandatory minimum sentences and the Rockefeller drug laws of 1973.
Right. Well, right now, Amy, we have just hired a new girl to run our state chapter. She's going to be working right in Albany. Meeting with
the state capitol.
Yes, with key politicians, just mainly on the Rockefeller drug laws. We had at one time had a girl that worked out in our Michigan, and they turned over the 650 lifer law there. That was in effect in Michigan, and now we're going to work mainly on the Rockefeller drug laws right here in New York. And we have a lot of other organizations that are involved with us that have been fighting with us for the last few years.
And just to clarify, when you talk about the 650 lifer law, that's the 20-year-old law in Michigan that required life in prison without parole for drug offenders convicted of intent to deliver 650 grams or more of heroin or cocaine.
Correct.
Well, we have to wrap up now because we have a last segment to go to and stations have to identify themselves. But I want to give Virginia Ressner a chance to give out the phone number of Families Against Mandatory Minimums in California.
Okay. Well, the number here in California is area code 415-753-6602.
That's 415-753-6602. And on the East Coast, Susan Stoner?
It's 518-674-0648.
That's 518-674-0648. And I also know that there are going to be large rallies in New York State on January 6th, the first day of the 106th congressional term, and March 2nd, particularly focusing on the Rockefeller drug laws. And among those organizing are the William Moses Kunstler Memorial Fund. And that phone number is 212-924-6980. That's 212-924-6980. I want to thank all of our guests for being with us again in these few days after Christmas, when a lot of families were hopeful around the country for clemency. We felt it was very important to bring you information on why so many people are in prison today, the overwhelming majority not for violent crimes. And we'll continue to bring you this story. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! And when we come back, We'll go international and look here at home. We'll look at the banana wars and particularly the role of Chiquita Banana, a large multinational corporation based in Cincinnati, Ohio. Stay with us.
Young mama, young mama, you just need a little time, maybe a new fella to talk about what's on your mind, young mama.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Escalating a nasty trade fight with the European Union over bananas, the Clinton administration announced last week it will slap hundreds of millions of dollars in punitive tariffs on European products, ranging from sheep's milk, cheese, to cashmere sweaters. U.S. Trade Representative Charlene Barshefsky says the U.S. is exercising its rights under the World Trade Organization to impose penalties on the 15-nation European Union for unfairly blocking U.S. companies from selling Latin American bananas to Europe. This decision is seen by some as a multi-million-dollar Christmas gift to the Cincinnati-based Chiquita Banana Company. Its politically influential boss, millionaire businessman Carl Lindner, blames much of its $457 million losses since 92 on what he sees as the European Union's unfair trade practices. Chiquita, once lucrative 40% share of the European banana market, has been cut in half over the last 5 years. Joining us to talk about the affairs of Chiquita and affairs of state is Larry Burns, executive director of the Washington-based Council on Hemispheric Affairs. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Hi, Amy.
Well, tell us what these trade sanctions that the U.S. government is threatening to impose against the European Union countries, what they have to do with Chiquita.
Well, we're talking about a very small amount of money here. We're talking about the world's two greatest economies, the EU, with it, France, Britain, Germany, and so forth, and the United States. The economic consequences right now would be roughly, I think, $300 million, $300 to $600 million could be affected in a total trade of probably $280 billion. So the amount of funds involved is pretty small, but this could get away with itself in terms of retaliations, then counter-retaliations, and a real trade war between the two blocs. The United States is also extremely apprehensive over the penetrations that the EU is making into the Latin American market, which is the fourth largest market, world market, and which has right now a GDP of approximately $1 trillion. U.S. trade officials look upon the EU now as real competition for and providing Latin America with an option other than the free trade area of the Americas, which the Clinton administration is aggressively trying to push. But what really is involved here is ethics, propriety, and common sense, none of which characterized Clinton administration policy.
What does Chiquita have to do with this?
Chiquita is big, or Chiquita is awesome in the impact it's having on this market. First of all, as you suggested, Carl Lindner is a very rich man. He's amongst the 400 richest men in America. He also has a credit card that gets him into the Lincoln bedroom at the White House. He also has access to the U.S. trade officials. For example, every year, hundreds of U.S. companies try to get the United States to make their cases, to put their cases on the agenda before the World Trade Organization. Actually, the United States only puts three or four cases every year on that agenda. One of them, mirabile dictu, was Chiquita, even though the United States doesn't produce a single banana, nor is a single U.S. job involved. What was involved was the fact that Carl Lindner, who has been the biggest campaign contributor, soft money, to the Republicans, all of a sudden became a big-time contributor to the Democrats. And in fact, the morning after Mickey Cantor, the then special trade officer of the White House, introduced a petition before the WTO on Chiquita's behalf, a $500,000 contribution was made, not to the Democratic National Committee, but to a series of state committees where the reporting function is much less visible. And so it clearly, Mr. Lindner bought himself a U.S. foreign policy. Now, Mickey Cantor protested at the time. He said, look, Carl, this is almost a quote, Carl Lindner didn't get everything that he asked for. I guess meaning that he got a lot of what he asked for.
People may remember, actually, there was a PBS special on this that began with the scene of Paula Poundstone, the comedian, who was at a fundraiser for Clinton, and the president was there. And she turned to him. She said, I always wondered who gets to sit next to the president. And she turned to the guy next to him and says, what do you do? What do you do? And the guy first wouldn't talk, and he says, I'm the banana man. And it turned out it was Carl Lindner.
Right. Remember that Chiquita is the successor of United Fruit. And, you know, I've studied the corporate culture of Chiquita for many years now. In fact, I have been raided by their – we have been raided by their lawyers, and I've experienced all sorts of skullduggery in there. I mean, personally, I'll tell you – please let me tell you the story of the foreign minister, my meeting with the foreign minister of Honduras.
Oh, I think you're talking about the foreign minister of Chiquita.
No, well, in a sense, the – the lawyers for Chiquita are the foreign ministry of Honduras, which, next to Argentina, has probably the most corrupt judiciary of any country in the world, and it's clearly in Chiquita's pocket. Chiquita, as a company, its writ is supreme not only in the United States, but also throughout much of Latin America. It has been for a long time a policy of Chiquita that it feels much more comfortable to have people on its payroll, be they U.S. embassy officials, Honduran, Colombian, Costa Rican government officials, judges. This is their M.O. And they are extremely litigious. They have an enormous law cadre at their behalf of lawyers. One of them, I mean, many of their lawyers coming from Kirkland and Ellis, the law firm of Ken Starr, which is known for its conservative politics and its antique antics in the way that they prosecute their cases. So we're talking about a very, very problematic corporation that has learned to use its campaign funding to buy influence in order to get U.S. policy changed. Now, the changes to U.S. policy would be tragic, particularly for the English-speaking Caribbean, which produces a relatively small amount of high-cost bananas on family farms. 50% of the families in Antigua, in St. Lucia, Grenada, grow bananas. They depend upon the sale of bananas for their livelihood. If no bananas, they're going to grow into drug trafficking. Already, the English-speaking Caribbean is the second most important drug route for cocaine to come up to the United States. And so what U.S. policy is doing, if they are successful, they will destroy the Caribbean banana economy and thus either promoting illegal immigration to the United States on the part of desperate people or these people will turn to drug trafficking.
We're talking to Larry Burns, executive director of the Council on Hemispheric Affairs. It's based in Washington, but he, fortunately, is with us today in New York. Now, you were talking about your conversation with the Honduran foreign minister, and we do want to get to that. Our regular listeners may remember when Cincinnati Inquirer came out with an amazing expose of Chiquita. Within a matter of weeks, it was pulled from everywhere, including every website, and the Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter who had done most of the investigation was indicted. He has now pled guilty. It had to do with how he got some of the information that he got from Chiquita, having to do with phone mail and voicemail and getting into the Chiquita voicemail system. We still don't know that whole story. But we extensively looked at what the allegations were in the Cincinnati Inquirer piece before they are paying now $15 million to Chiquita as an apology for what they did, although nothing that they have said in the pieces that they did, this series of articles, has been retracted. Now, you were, in a tangential way, involved with this story, Larry Burns.
Yeah, well, I would say more than tangential, since we supplied the Cincinnati Reporter with a great deal of his material, which we had long known about but couldn't prove. They had the resources to investigate the story, and Mike Gallagher did a superb job in doing this. Now, the voicemail, one of the voicemails regarded our organization, and it had several Chiquita lawyers, high officials, senior officials in Cincinnati discussing how to keep information from me that they had received confidential papers that I had given to the Honduran foreign minister. It went like this. I received a phone call from the Honduran embassy a year and a half or so ago, saying that Honduras was extremely troubled by the fact that charges that we made about their judges being corrupt had appeared in the front pages of the Honduran press, and that they wanted to see the backup evidence that we had regarding these charges. So I said to the ambassador, I'd be glad to turn over this material. Then he calls me back and he says, you know, our foreign minister right now, as we speak, is in Canada, and he would like to meet with you. So he arranged for a Saturday 7 a.m. meeting, which was about a year or so ago, about this time. We met at a hotel in New York, in Washington. He said, you know, historically, we were a banana republic, but we're not a banana republic any longer, and Chiquita is just another company doing business in Honduras. So I said, ah. And he said, give us the papers, and we will track down these charges of yours. And I said to him, I think probably what you'll do is deliver them immediately to the Honduran embassy. And he laughed at me. He said,
I told you. To the Honduran embassy?
At the Honduran embassy in Washington. He said, I told you that we're no longer a banana republic. Well, then I listened to the tape that Mike Gallagher plays for me. And what happened was, within 20 minutes after those papers of mine had been turned over to the Honduran officials, they had been delivered to the Chiquita lawyers in Washington who were photocopying them. I mean, when I listened to the tape, it didn't amaze me because I knew it was going to happen to me, since I knew that Argentina, that Honduras is basically a function of Chiquita Banana Company. And so when we brought out the charges and so forth, the Honduran authorities sniffily dismissed them.
And you were saying that your allegations were that it was not just the Honduran judiciary was corrupt, but that they were on the payroll of Chiquita?
Oh, yes. Yes. Not only that, you know, we wanted to know why the former vice counsel of the U.S. Embassy in Tegucigalpa, who had granted a visa to a judge named Galindo, who had been, I mean, without question, had been bribed by Chiquita to come forth with decisions on their behalf in a series of famous cases regarding Chiquita's operations in Honduras, that this man was given a visa to come to the United States just after he had been suspended from the Honduran judiciary and was about to be impeached. So this man, a man named Sanchez, gives Galindo his visa, and 6 months later, Sanchez is hired by Chiquita to be the vice president for public affairs of Chiquita Banana in Honduras.
And Sanchez was?
An American, had been the vice counsel at the U.S. Embassy.
Hmm. We just have 2 minutes to go, Larry Burns, and I wanted to ask you a question relevant to today and Chiquita, and that is Hurricane Mitch in Honduras, the terrible devastation, and what Chiquita has done for the country that it has taken so much out of, Honduras.
No, it's laid off all of its workers. It's one of some. I mean, Chiquita is very big on PR. For example, Lindner spoke about all the hospitals and all the schools that Chiquita had provided the Honduras. In fact, it had been United Fruit that built the hospitals and the schools, and Chiquita had taken them off the corporate payroll and had given them back to Honduras because they didn't want to have to bear the expenses. That is, the fact is that Carl Lindner, when he got the company, its stock was something like 30 to 40. It's now below 10. And the company has been disastrously run by Lindner, and he covers it up by projecting the need that is he is now on a righteous crusade to get his fitting market in Europe, and if he gets that market, all will be the economic prospects of the company will be reversed. The fact is that the English speaking percentage of that market is less than 8%. It has absolutely no impact on the overall banana thing. But Lindner has used this to divert attention from the way he's running this company into the ground.
And at the same time, I suppose you could say running Honduras into the ground.
Oh, yes.
How many workers? Something like 12,000?
12,000. They had 12,000 contract workers.
So the hurricane happens and they just let go.
That itself is such a story how in order to get out of union contracts, Lindner ostensibly sold the land, but actually controlled the land through trusts, land trusts that were registered in the Channel Islands in England. This is some of the stuff that Mike Gallagher had exposed in his series.
If people want to get hold of the Council of Foreign Relations in Washington, where
Council
can they call?
Council on Hemispheric Relations.
Council on.
Well, Council on Foreign Relations.
Council on Hemispheric Relations. Where can they call? We have 20 seconds.
All right. They can call 202-216-9261, 202-216-9261.
Thank you very much, Larry Burns, Executive Director of the Washington-based Council on Hemispheric Affairs. That does it for today's show. If you'd like a copy of the program, you can call the archives at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mario Murillo with help from Max Pringle, our technical director, Errol Maitland. Julie Drizin's our executive producer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.